So I want to pick up in April 29, 1922. One who lives in the divine will lives from an eternal heartbeat. Okay? Notice the eternal. Finding myself in my usual state, I saw my soul and all of my interior, the thoughts, affections, heartbeats and tendencies, changed into many threads of light. Now, don't ask me to explain how she could see all of these aspects of herself as threads of light. It's an incredible mystery, okay? But she's obviously seeing it somehow symbolically in a vision, okay? Now, threads of light means that they have been spiritualized because matter has got to be spiritualized if we're to live at a divine level. Okay, so that's the threads of light. So each thing then, the thoughts, the affections, the heartbeats, everything is being transformed at the level of the divine will. And these extended and expanded so much because the Lord increases our capacity all the time, okay? That coming out from within my interior, they harmonized with the sun. Now, don't forget the sun is the source of light. Rose higher, touched the heavens and diffused over the whole earth because all divine acts cover everything and everyone. While I was watching this, I saw my sweet Jesus, who was holding all of these threads of light in his hand. So there you have the light holding the rays of light, if I could just put it slightly differently. And with enchanting mastery, he directed them. He stretched them. They have to grow. He multiplied them and he enlarged them as much as he wanted. So he's doing all the work. What we do is hand over everything to him. The thoughts, the words, the affections, absolutely everything. He does the work. So I want you to put Philippians 1:6 there, that he will complete the work if we don't block it. Okay? At the touch of that light, all created things lowered down, harmonized together and made feast. And for that, I want you to put Romans 8:19, that all creation is waiting for these sons of God to show themselves so it can be redeemed as well. Then my sweet Jesus told me, my daughter, have you seen how I love to enjoy myself and direct the acts done in my will? My jealousy is such that I do not entrust them to anyone, not even to the soul herself. I would say least of all to the soul herself. Sure, we don't know the half of what's going on. I leave not a thought, not a fibre, without enclosing all the power of my will. Now, I want you to notice all. Sometimes a word changes everything because we're used to saying that the divine will takes over. All of my divine will means the whole operating part of the Blessed Trinity. I mean, if you can take that in, you're better than everybody else I ever heard of. And he himself says in the higher volumes that human nature finds it practically impossible to actually grasp what the meaning of that is. Each one of these acts contains a divine life, naturally because it's coming from a divine source. Therefore, at the touch of these acts, all created things feel the life of the Creator, because these acts touch everything and everyone. Okay? And the life of the Creator, John 1:4, that Jesus is the light of life, and John 14:6, I am the way, the truth and the life. So all created things feel the life of their Creator. They feel once again the strength of that omnipotent fiat from which they came into existence, and they make feast. In other words, they feel as if where Adam left off, it's restarting. Okay? That the whole of creation is picking up again. Therefore, these acts are new glory and new feast for them. That's all created things. In other words, some human being is picking up where Adam left off. So in the next paragraph, there's a very important warning. for anyone trying to live at the level of divine will, and that is you produce either light or darkness. There isn't a grey in between. Okay. Now, as for this beautiful harmony, these threads of light that come out from your interior, if your heart did not flow in my will, but in your own will or in another will, many heartbeats of divine life would be missing in your heart, while many human heartbeats would take over for as many as those that are missing to the divine. And so with the fibres and the affections and so on. And since what is human is not capable of forming light, but only darkness, many threads of darkness would be formed, and my volition would remain saddened, unable to carry out all the power of my will within you. So here's the problem we have at the beginning of the whole adventure in the divine will, that if we haven't completely handed over our whole being to the Lord, there's threads of light and darkness inside of us. That means there's contradictory things in us. And human beings, we recognize contradictory things all the time, don't we? But what the Lord wants is that we eventually hand over everything so that it all becomes light with no darkness. Of course, if there are threads of darkness within us, there is an opening for the enemy to attack because he operates through darkness. If there are bits of selfishness which represents darkness in us, the enemy has an opening to attack us. While he was saying this, I wanted to see whether there were these human heartbeats in my soul, because Louisa is by now aware of the fact that many of the messages given to her are not necessary for herself, but they're given to her for us. Okay, so hence she wants to see, are there any of these threads of darkness in herself, which would interrupt the life of the divine heartbeat? But as much as I looked, I couldn't find any. Look at that. That's incredible, isn't it? And Jesus said, for now, there's nothing. Why does he say for now? Because human beings can change any minute. I have told you this to make you attentive and to let you know what it means to live in the divine will. You have to add the two little words. It is to live from an eternal and divine heartbeat, to live with the omnipotent breath. The heartbeat and the breath, the Holy Spirit, the breath of God, Ruach Adonai. Okay. So May the 8th, 1922. Continuing my usual state, Blessed Jesus just barely made himself seen, like a flash that runs away. The next sentence has this, now that, and now the other, so I change it. At first he showed the shadow of his light and then his hand. I felt an indescribable pain, and he, caressing my face with his hand, told me, poor daughter, how much you suffer, and immediately he withdrew. Now, he recognises the pain, he sympathised for a blink of an eye and then disappeared. What is she going to do? In the past, she has mostly complained, but this time, Louisa gains the victory. You see, if you battle with something long enough, you'll eventually overcome it. Okay, so watch this. And my heading for the next paragraph is Victory at Last. Now, she has managed once before. So I thought to myself, Jesus told me many times that he loves me very much and that he suffers greatly when he sees that I suffer because of his privation. Who knows how much he suffers now? You see, she's not thinking of herself this time. She's thinking of him. In seeing me petrified by the pain of his privation. So in order not to make him suffer so much, this is all him this time, so it's total victory. Okay, I want to pluck up my strength, try to be more content, less oppressed, more attentive in maintaining my flight, my attitude to his will, so as to bring him my kiss. Wow. Not an embittered one, but peaceful and content, which will not sadden him, but rather console him. Therefore, you have to apply Revelation chapters 2 and 3 to her. She has become an overcomer. and all the promises for the overcomers will be given to her. Now, this is volume 14. She's had one dreadful battle to reach this point. Okay, but she gets there. So she has scaled Mount Everest at last. While I was thinking of this, he came out from within my interior, all sorrowful, with his heart all wounded. In the centre of it, a wound could be seen and a little flame coming out from within it. And he told me, "My daughter, indeed, the more I see you suffer when I deprive you of myself, the greater the pain I feel." Now, what he's saying to her is, you have interpreted this correctly, is what he's saying. Because since your pain is caused by the privation of me, it's nothing other than the effect of the love that you have for me. Therefore, if you are embittered and oppressed, your heartbeat echoes in mine, and I feel your bitterness and oppression. Oh, if you knew how much I suffer when I see you suffer because of me, you would always use this caution, this attention, so as not to embitter me more. These are the pains of one who loves me the most. That's a very important point, okay? Which are in continuous currents in my heart. There's an extraordinary unity between the two of them. And there's nothing that she undergoes that he doesn't experience as well. It's difficult for us to take that on board. See, the wound that you see in the centre of my heart from which the little flame comes out is precisely yours. But be consoled, if it gives me the highest, or we would say the greatest pain, it also gives me the highest or the greatest love. You, however, stay calm. He's been telling her this for 14 volumes now. And I will go forward to fulfil my justice. Because she just has not accepted the fact that when he doesn't come, he's out there chastising the world. But I do not leave you, Joshua 1:5. I will return often, be it even in a flash, and I will not cease to make my little visits. Now, little visits means for 2 seconds or 3 seconds or whatever. So May the 8th, I think, is a very important victory moment for Louisa. So May the 12th, one who lives in the divine will concurs in everything that God does. Now, while theoretically Louisa would understand that, when she realizes that if I have to concur with everything that God does, one of the things he does is he chastises people. And then she goes into a tizzy. But by the time you get to volume 20, she understands everything. And the way the Lord solves the problem for her is to say to her, okay, Louisa, now we're tired talking about this. And he says, here, there's the world. You look after it. You tell me what you're going to do. And she realizes in a very short time she'd kill them all. And she says, no, I don't have your patience. I don't have your forbearance. I don't have your... But it was only when he handed her over the key of justice and said, you operate it. It was then she said, okay, the most perfect thing is for me to conform to you. So when you operate justice, it's wise, it's ordered, it's not disordered. It's wise, it's loving, it's humble, it's patient, it's kind, just as all the attributes of God have all the other attributes to make it perfect. You know what I mean? But we're inclined to think that justice is terrible and that mercy is nice. But what you read in these writings and also in the scriptures is that justice is merciful and justice is wise and justice is kind and justice is all the other things as well. All the attributes of God interweave to make one extraordinary thing which Jesus calls love. Okay, so the parent who decides at a particular moment that if a child is not corrected right now, that there will be trouble later, even though it may cost the parent a lot to do the chastisement that they, or the correction they have to do, they do it out of a very mature love. Am I correct?
Yes.
Yeah. And so the child only feels it as pain. But if you read the letter to the Hebrews, chapter 12, which we've read at Mass recently, then the Lord says, but every father has to correct his children, everybody. Otherwise, the children will never become mature adults. So this correction thing is actually chastisement. Because when we hear it as chastisement, it's that the correction is coming to the human race as distinct from an individual, okay? So May the 12th, Louisa said, I was thinking to myself, who knows in what I have offended him that my sweet Jesus doesn't come as usual? Have you noticed she slipped back to a previous position? And that's us. You may have actually won the victory and then we're creatures of habit and you slip back to the same thinking again. You've never had that problem, have you? And it's just wonderful for me to see a saint having the same difficulties. Now, it's on a different level to what most of us are having, you know what I mean? But it's wonderful for me to see it, you know. I don't know, I find this very consoling. How can it be possible that without any reason and the goodness of his most holy heart, which easily overabounds towards those who love him, it could resist so many calls of mine without any reason? And he has told her for 14 volumes that he's chastising. It's nothing to do with her. It's fascinating, isn't it? I don't know, do you find it fascinating? Now, while I was thinking of this and other things, he came out from within my interior. He hadn't gone anywhere. And covering me completely with a mantle of most refulgent light, she is wrapped in a robe of light. That is Psalm 104, verse 2. Lord, the Psalm says, you are full of majesty and glory. You are wrapped in a robe of light. So he wraps her in a robe of light, okay, in such a way that I could see nothing but light. This is her first big sort of plunging into the immensity of the divine will, which is light. Okay. He told me, my daughter, what do you fear? See, in order to keep you safe and well defended, I surrounded you with this mantle of light, which of course is the divine will, so that no creature and nothing may harm you. And then, why do you want to waste time thinking that you have offended me? The poison of guilt has not entered into one who lives in the divine will. Very, very important. Now, I think, I've only remembered it this minute and you would think I hadn't prepared it. I think that's 1 John 3:2, that somebody truly in union with God cannot sin. Okay? And if you misinterpret it, you can go wrong. But the point is that if your will is in union with God's will, therefore you're in union with sanctity itself, you cannot be in that position and sin. You just can't do it. Is that okay? And we already know from very much earlier volumes that if you sin, the divine will leaves. Okay? So the poison of guilt, that means that you've committed sin, has not entered into one who lives in my will. Besides, your Jesus would strike you with lightning if he saw you, even with little stains of sin. Why? Because she's come so close. I would put you out of the circle of my will and you would immediately lose the attitude of operating in my divine volition. Okay? So here's three scriptures you need to have. Okay? The usual one is Hebrews 12:14, that nothing unholy or unworthy can enter the presence of God. The second one is Revelation 21:27. Anyone still sinning cannot enter the holy city, the New Jerusalem. And Isaiah 35:8, sinners may not walk along this holy highway. A sinner is somebody rebelling against God. Okay. So I wanted to give you a few of them. I usually only give you Hebrews 12:14 because it's at the surface of my head. So he's now going to tell us in the next paragraph that real sanctity is demanded of us if we claim we're living in the divine will. Okay. So we've been elevated to a divine level. So it's not ordinary sanctity he's looking for us. He is actually looking for a divine sanctity. Okay. So he's asking something of us that has not been asked of all the saints that have gone before us. Ah, my daughter, the sanctity of my will is not yet known. Each kind of sanctity has its own special distinction. You know, some of them were penitents, some of them were monks, some of them were missionaries, some of them were teachers, some of them whatever. Okay, each kind of sanctity has its own special distinction. Many are surprised in hearing that I come often to you. In fact, the church was completely shocked. I mean, because this didn't happen before. Since it has not been my usual way to do that with other souls. So the Lord admits to her he doesn't behave like that with the rest of us. The sanctity of my volition is inseparable from me. Now, throughout these volumes, certainly from volume 14 upwards, every reference to Blessed Mother is my inseparable mother. And when you get to a certain stage, I think it's around volume 25, it's my inseparable Louisa. Okay, so that she has actually made the grade. So to truly reach this divine sanctity, we are inseparable from him. So the question of sin and darkness and stuff does not enter the picture. Okay. And in order to elevate the creature to the divine level, it is necessary for me to keep her either identified with my humanity or in the light of my divinity. In other words, to go through his humanity or to go directly through the divinity. There may be people in the future who will go directly through the divinity. Otherwise, how could the soul maintain the attitude of operating in my will if my working and hers are not one? So there has to be union. What John of the Cross considered the highest point in human experience, which was divine union, is the basis. It's the ground you stand on in the divine will. It's absolutely incredible. So, you know, where we've been told that each generation grows on the shoulders of the last one. We're growing on the shoulders of the greatest of the saints. I mean, when we look, well, I don't know about you, but when I look at myself in a mirror, I say, Lord, are you sure? Are you sure? It's just incredible what he's doing with us. Okay. So, in the next paragraph, Jesus talks about divine sanctity and he also explains his deprivation. He explains this so often to Louisa, you could write a book on it. Now, the soul who lives in my will, number one, takes part in all of my attributes. That means wisdom, love, patience, kindness, forgiveness, justice, all the others. Okay. Secondly, and together with me, she concurs in each one of my acts. Therefore, it has to be justice as well. Do you see that? You're either in union or you're not. Therefore, she must concur with me also in the acts of justice. That's just plain logic. This is why when I want to chastise, I hide my humanity from you, but not his divinity. He always leaves the divine will with her. Okay. Which is more accessible to the human nature. And that's what she's been pleading for all the time, that she would see him in his humanity. But by the time she gets up into the volume 20s, she's so used to being in the divine will that it's fine, you know. In such a way that in the reflections of my humanity, you feel the love and the compassion that I have towards souls. And you snatch from me the scourges with which I want to strike them. Then when creatures do so much as to force me to strike them, hiding my humanity from you, I raise you into the light of my divinity. That's the mantle of light that he spoke about earlier, okay? And it, that is the divine will, absorbs you and you delight in it. Now that's like saying, I take the little light of a candle and I plunge it into a huge fire. Are you going to see the candle afterwards? No. Will you see the tiny flame? No. You'll only see the fire. And so you'll from the volume 20 onwards, you'll hear Louisa saying, I can't see anything and I can't see Jesus. I can't see anything. I only see light. You know what I mean? Because that's the divine, that's the fire taking over. So the divine will absorbs you and you delight in it. But you do not feel the reverberations of my humanity because you're on a higher level. Is that okay? And I, being left free, I strike the creatures. Therefore, either A, I manifest my humanity to you, making you concur together with me in the acts of mercy towards creatures, or B, I absorb you into the light of my divinity, making you concur in the acts of justice. And she doesn't realize it, that when he has lifted her into the divine will, she has actually concurred with the very stuff that she says she doesn't want to do. It's amazing, isn't it? Do you notice the Lord has his own way of getting around us? So I absorb you into the light of my divinity, making you concur in the acts of justice. But you are always with me. Even more, when I absorb you in the light of my divinity, it is a greater grace that I give you. Because at a much higher level, okay? The reason why he says it's a greater grace is that that normally only happens after your death. While you, not seeing my humanity, lament that I deprive you of myself and do not appreciate the grace that you receive. Perfectly understandable. It's the first time this has been heard on planet Earth when Louisa hears it. On hearing that I was concurring with the acts of justice, notice the only thing she picks up, she doesn't pick up the extraordinary privilege of being at this level. The only thing she says, oh no, no justice. This is fascinating to me. No, my love, she says, now you are striking the creatures, making their houses collapse. Am I doing this together with you? No, no, heaven forbid that I should touch my brothers. When you do strike them, I will make myself small in your will, as if she had the freedom to do that, you know. I will not diffuse myself in it so as not to take part in what you are doing. In everything, I want to do what you do, which is a contradiction in terms. So if in everything she wants to do what he does, she has to do the chastisement as well. It's lovely to see her battling with this, you know. But in this, striking creatures, never. You see the way she's contradicting herself? And Jesus said, why are you so frightened? In my will, you cannot be exempt from doing what I do. We are one. Is that okay? It's a bit like the fingers saying, I'm not going to cooperate with what the hand is doing. Sorry, dear, but you're part of it. To do nothing of one's own, but you do whatever God does. That's what it means, living in the divine will. And besides, my justice is sanctity and love. Now, there's the thing that people do not associate with justice, that it is actually love. But if you think in terms of chastisement or correction and think of correcting a child, you'll understand that it actually is love. And besides, my justice is sanctity and love, and it serves to balance the divine rights. We're going through a stage in society where we're on a my rights thing role, and no question of God having any rights. That's like children saying, my right to this, that and the other, and the parents have no rights. And you're saying, no, excuse me, that we're all in this thing together. Okay. And so God's rights as creator, Lord, redeemer, sanctifier, everything, they have got to be looked at. If I did not have justice, all the fullness of perfection would be lacking to my divinity. Isn't that interesting? There can be nothing lacking in the divinity. So if you want to live in my volition and do not want to take part in the acts of justice, the sanctity done in my will would not have its full completion. They are two waters fused together. I think if you change the word water to ocean, that two oceans have come together and they are now one. Can you separate two oceans that meet? No, you cannot. Okay. One is forced to do what the other does. On the other hand, if they are separated, each one follows its own course. We would say its own course. You wouldn't just say its course. My will and yours are the two oceans or waters that are fused together. And whatever one does, the other must do as well. Therefore, I want you always in my will. He says that because she's reacting to justice. So here's the grace. I abandoned all of myself to his will. Because you don't realise what Louise is actually saying when she says, I abandoned all of myself. So this is all my resistance, everything goes. But I felt great repugnance in me towards justice. And my sweet Jesus coming back told me, if you knew how heavy it is for me to use justice, and how much I love the creature, the whole of creation is for me, watch this, like the body to the soul, like the skin to the fruit. I am in continuous, immediate act with man, although created things hide me just as the body hides the soul. Very interesting, isn't it? However, if it wasn't for the soul, the body wouldn't live. In the same way, if I withdrew from created things, they would all remain without life, because the divine will alone maintains everything in life. In all created things, I visit man, I touch him, and I give him life. So, number one, I am hidden in the fire, and I visit him with its heat. And if I were not there, the fire would have no heat. It would be a painted fire without life. But while I visit man in the fire, he doesn't recognize me, and he doesn't give me even one greeting. Number two, I am in the water. That is, the divine will is present. And I visit him by quenching his thirst. If I didn't do that, it would be dead water. But while I visit him, he passes before me, you know, and there's no recognition. Number three, I am hidden in the food. And I visit man by giving him substance, strength, and taste. If I were not there in taking food, man would remain on an empty stomach without nourishment, he means. Yet ungrateful, while he feeds on me, he turns his back to me. I think the next one is four, isn't it? Mm-hmm. I am hidden in the sun, and I visit him with my light at almost every instant. Yet ungrateful, he repays me with continual offences. Number five, I visit him in all things, in the air he breathes, in the flower that gives off the fragrance, in the breeze that refreshes, in the thunder that strikes, in everything, my visits are innumerable. Do you see how much I love him? And you, being in my will, are together with me, visiting man and giving him life. That's the absolutely brilliant bit, isn't it? Because if you are with him, if you're one with him, then you're going as well. So while you are doing your acts and prayers in the divine will, you may not be conscious of the fact that you're reaching out to every human being on the planet. That's the bit I try to remain conscious of, that everything that I'm doing is affecting everybody. I'm praying for the 7.5 billion people on the planet. I'll never know them except in heaven. And then to be really aware of the past and the future. To me, that gives what I call vump to the prayers. Do you know what I mean? It really gives you that energy to go ahead and do it. Together with me, you are visiting man and giving him life. Isn't that fantastic? So therefore, do not be frightened if sometimes you concur with justice. I love the sometimes. In other words, he's trying to ease the way for her to understand that she's not asking for cities to be destroyed. She's asking for the human race to come back to the Lord. That's actually what you're asking. So May the 15th, she goes right back and you have the laments and fears again. I just love this because you have somebody great enough to tell you, I'm not always in the right place. Do you know what I mean? And I may have a great relationship with God, but I still go through the to-ing and fro-ing. But this time, when she complains, because she made it to the summit before, this time she gets a proper telling off, which I love as well, because it tells you that this is a real relationship, you know. Continuing my usual state, I felt all oppressed because of the privation of my sweet Jesus. Now, while I was praying, I felt there was someone behind my shoulders, and not knowing that it was Jesus, I had a shiver of fright. He stretched out his arm, and taking my hand in his hand, he told me, "Louisa, do not fear, it is I." You see, it is I. Write it down. Ego Eimi. E-G-O. E-I-M-I. E-G-O. E-I-M-I. They're the exact words that God said to Moses when Moses said, "What is your name?" He said, "Ego Eimi." That is usually given in English as "I am who I am." Okay. But it's the way he identifies himself as divine. Okay. "Oppressed as I was," Louisa said, "and tired of waiting for him," I said, "it shows that you no longer love me as before." Oh dear. We've slipped down the ladder a bit, haven't we? "You've taken everything away from me, even suffering. You alone were left to me, but so very often you fly away and I don't know what to do nor where to find you. It's really true that you don't love me anymore." Now watch this. And Jesus, assuming a dignified appearance, such as to strike fear, said, "You offend me by telling me that I no longer love you as before. Mind this well. For the mere suspicion that I may not love you, it is the greatest offence to me." How is that for a ticking off? Yes, somebody pulled up rather short. Because what she's been falling back into the, what I call the feminine emotional thing. And he's saying, snap out of it. You're not there. You've left all that stuff behind. You're on a different planet. And would you please realise who you're dealing with and stop playing baby stuff? You know, we do have to say sometimes to human beings, it's growing up time, mm-hmm. You know. Okay, but she has been ticked off before, but not as severely as this. Okay. So even the mere suspicion that I may not love you is the greatest offense to me. Why? Because God is love. 1 John 4:7. God is love. What? I don't love you. I don't love you. So you hold all the graces I'm giving to you as trifles. In other words, she doesn't really grasp what he's doing. Louisa said, "I was left confused and I really trembled in seeing the severe look of Jesus. And in the depths of my heart, I implored forgiveness and pity." So he softened and he said, "Promise me that you will not say that anymore." This is a real relationship, isn't it? In other words, we're not going down this route again. I'll let you off now. And to show you that I love you, I want to make you suffer, letting you share in my pains. What did she complain about? "I don't even suffer anymore." So he says, "Okay, you want to suffer? I'll let you suffer." So after then, I suffered a little and he repeated, "Now I want to show you that I love you." Okay. So he showed his heart opened and immense seas of power, wisdom, goodness, love, beauty, sanctity came out from within. This explains why he said to say that I don't love you is the greatest offence that you can possibly give. And now he lets her somehow grasp what he's actually saying. Okay. "The more I looked, the more I remained confused. And Jesus said, 'Have you seen how much I love you? And how not only in my heart, but in all my," you'd have to add the word divine, "attributes. I carry your name written, and your name is written in me. It makes ever new currents of grace and light and love, etc., open up to you. And yet you tell me that I don't love you. How can you even suspect this?" Can you hear somebody's upset? Okay. "Only Jesus knows how crushed I was left," she said, "thinking that I had offended my Jesus and even in his presence." Of course, that's what we do when we sin, because God is ever present. "Oh, how awful guilt is," she said. Okay. I think that particular message is one that really needs to be looked at, because the Lord is saying to us, you know, you mightn't appreciate what I'm actually offering you. You mightn't realize that I'm actually serious. And that I'm offering you graces way beyond anything you could possibly imagine. And it's not just mere devotion. It's not just fancy prayers that you're saying. This is real reality. This is me lifting you up to a level that you can't even imagine. But there's huge responsibility going with it as well. Okay, that's why I think that message is terribly important. So May the 19th, 1922, Louisa says, "Continue in my usual state, my beloved Jesus made himself seen within my interior, from which a little door opened and he leaned his arms on it and he put his head out to see what the other creatures were doing. But he has told her, you see, in the early volumes that you are my throne on the earth and that is from you that I look out at the other creatures. And because I'm looking at them from you, I'm looking at them through the eyes of someone who loves me and therefore I won't be as heavy on them as they deserve." And so you have to remember these things from the past to interpret the present. So I looked together with Jesus, and who can say how many evils that appeared, the offences being given and the chastisements that will pour down. This sight was so sorrowful and so horrifying. I also saw our poor country being struck by the divine scourge. Now, seeing that Jesus was looking with such tenderness of love and sorrow, while in the previous days it had been impossible for me to get him to look and to turn his face towards creatures, I said to him, "My love and my life, do you see how much your dear brothers and mine suffer?" Now, notice they're not creatures now. They're not even your images. She's really moving in. They're your dear brothers and mine. Don't you want to have pity? So she's calling on mercy, not on justice. How willingly would I suffer everything so that they might be spared? See, this is a duty that the state of victim imposes on me, the imitation of you. Did you not suffer everything for us? And how could you want me not to suffer in order to spare them and to imitate you who suffered so much? So Jesus interrupted me and told me, "Ah, my daughter, man has reached such..." This is 1906, isn't it? Mm-hmm. 22. "Man has reached such a point that I cannot look at him except with horror." Now, there's already a world war behind us. And the First World War was billed as the war to end all wars. It didn't end anything. It didn't solve anything. And here in 1922, you have the Lord saying that they've reached such a stage that he looks at them with horror. Isn't that unbelievable? Why is that? Because communism has taken over. Do you remember? And you have the communism, you have the Illuminati, and you have the other crowd, the Freemasons as well, wreaking havoc on the earth and destroying faith and destroying the church. And if I look at him, it's only from within you, because finding all the tenderness of my humanity and my prayers in you, I feel moved to look at him with compassion. Okay. And for love of you, I will spare their lives. Okay. When I was reading this, the thing that came very strongly to me was to look up the prayer in the hour. It's one of the hours of the crucifixion where you have the prayer to placate divine justice. If you look that up, it fits here perfectly. OK, it's in one of the hours of Jesus on the cross. And you hear him interceding with the Father and Louisa joining him in his intercession. And that's why she's saying, "But I have to do exactly what you've done." Okay. So finding all the tenderness of my humanity and my prayers in you, I feel moved to look at humanity with compassion, and for love of you, I will spare their lives. Now, has been telling us, and he'll tell us even more, that it's because of the people in the divine will that he will do everything for humanity. Man needs strong purges, otherwise he will not change his mind. In other words, it's the whole of humanity now that has become hard of heart. It's no longer just the people of Israel. Now, when you're studying the Old Testament, we see the disaster of the people of Israel becoming hard-hearted towards the Lord and the very strong chastisements that they needed. Now it's the whole world, okay? Really, it's the whole Western world. I shouldn't say the whole world, because I don't think it was Africa. Therefore, I will sweep everything away so as to renew everything. Now, notice you do one thing for another. You sweep everything away. If you're going to do a renovation of your house, all the old stuff comes down and the new stuff goes in. And all the correction in the system has got to be made. I will do unexpected things and new chastisements. So the unexpected things, Isaiah 48, 6 to 11. Isaiah 48, 6 to 11, where the Lord says, I have to do new things, things unexpected, things you can't explain, things that will happen and it will just absolutely take you by surprise, is to try and alert you to the fact that I exist. That has got to happen to the Western world. Okay. Now notice, but do not fear, for love of you, I will spare something. Now, from here on in, she begins to learn that he will spare one third for one person interceding in the divine will. That is massive. If you take one third of 7.5 billion, you realize that the power of this prayer is just unbelievable, okay? And sparing the one third fits in with the chastisements that are in the book of Revelation. And there are three waves of chastisement in the book of Revelation. And one third is spared. Okay. In you, I feel the current of communications with all creatures, just as I felt in my humanity. Therefore, it's hard for me to give you nothing and to content you with nothing. So one third is absolutely massive. Later on, Louisa said, I found myself outside of myself at a very high point. And I found my celestial mother, a late archbishop of ours, my parents, and my sweet Jesus. Now, that's quite a large company. She usually doesn't have a large company like that. so watch this. She found the celestial mother, a late archbishop of ours, my parents, and my sweet Jesus, who was in the arms of the bishop. As soon as he saw me, the bishop placed him in my arms. Now, this is very interesting because Louisa tells you very little about how the bishops reacted to her. And this was one of the archbishops whom she just simply refers to as Monsignor. This is very interesting. The bishop placed him in my arms, telling me, take him, my daughter, and enjoy him. Jesus made feast in my arms and said, dearest daughter of my will, I want to renew the bond of the great gift of making you live in my will. So the renewal of your vows, if I can put it that way. Okay, you made the vow to live in my divine will. I want to renew the vows. This is why I wanted here, present, as representatives, we would say witnesses. Notice the archbishop represents the church. Okay. My own dear mother, the first one who lived fully in the divine will after Adam, the bishop representing the church, watch this, who took part in your direction. Now, in the 14 volumes we've read and the rest of it that I've read, there isn't anything about a bishop directing her directly. But of course, he's doing it through the priests. Okay, and the priests are going back to him and the bishops have taken it all the way to Rome, even during Louisa's lifetime. So he wants the church present because he has insisted on the church being involved in this from the very beginning. So he took part in your direction while he was on earth, and your dear parents who were martyred when you were young, wondering what on earth was going on, so that you may remain confirmed more in my will. Now, notice that every now and then the Lord wants a confirmation of the commitment because human beings can change so easily. And you may receive all the current of the goods which my will contains. Now, notice the all, in case you slip out and let something slip out, so that they may be the first to receive the glory of the work of living in my will. Who are going to be the first? The parents. I think that's gorgeous. The parents, the Archbishop, Blessed Mother. Now, I've given it to you backways. in terms of importance, I've given it to you backwards. But look at the way everything is in extraordinary order, okay? So she has been raised to this level, with this level of confirmation and everything. And what does he do now? He tells her she's only an atom. What is he doing? Balancing. Terribly important to balance, because as human beings, we have this extraordinary ability to sort of receive that small little bit of self-glory. And you mightn't even be aware of it. The awful thing is half the time you're not aware of it. So when the Lord sends you a humiliation, what he's doing is trying to balance the grace to make sure you don't lose things. The worst thing you can be spiritually is a colander, because you lose most of the grace. The grace is living water, you see, and the living water will go through. So you are nothing but an atom in my will, okay? And in this atom, I place all the weight of my will. Now, that's the same as what he said earlier, all the fullness, okay, all the weight of my will. But that weight also has power, okay? So that as you move, the immensity of my volition may receive its motion. In other words, you move God to do something. Isn't that incredible? So as you move, the immensity of my volition may receive its motion, its waters may ripple, and as though stirred, they may give off their freshness, their fragrances, and may overflow for the good of heaven and earth. The atom is small. It is extremely light and is unable to agitate the immense sea of my will. But once all the weight of my will has been placed in it, it will be capable of everything. There is your famous bit, John 15:5, without him I can do nothing, and Philippians 4:13, with him I can do everything. But for the atom bit, I want to give you Psalm 8. What is man that you would even think of him or take care of him? And yet you've made him little less than a god and crowned him with glory and honour. Okay. So, Philippians 4:13. So this description of us and the balance between the enormity of the grace and the unimportance of the person it's given to is actually terribly important for balance. So the atom is small, extremely light, and is unable to agitate the immensity of my will. But once all the weight of my will has been placed in it, it will be capable of everything. And you will give me the field, that's the space, the opportunity to work, to release more divine acts from within myself. You will be like a little stone which is cast into a fount. And as it drops, the waters ripple, stir, and give off their freshness and fragrance. However, the little stone does not contain the weight of my will, and therefore cannot make the fount overflow. But your atom, with the weight of my divine will in it, cannot only overwhelm my sea, but can flood heaven and earth. It really needs to be taken word by word, not line by line. Okay. Watch this. You will drink all of my will. Okay. Now, beside that, I want you to put John 7:37-39. If you are thirsty, come and drink. And if you drink enough, out of your own being will flow fountains of living water. Okay. So you will drink all of my will with all the goods that it contains. And you'll do it as though in one gulp. You're doing it in one little act, you know. And in another gulp, you let it out. And the reason why you're letting it out is that it has got to go and affect everybody in heaven and on earth. And while you do this, you will multiply my life and my goods as many times, for as many times as you drink it and for as many times as you release it. So you multiply in the in gulp and in the out. Okay. And if the blessed in heaven enjoy all the beatitude which my will contains and live in it as in their own centre, they do not, however, multiply it because their merits are fixed. You can only have merits on earth. Okay. you are happier than they are. Now, by happier, he means more privileged. It doesn't mean jumping over the moon. Because you can multiply my life, my will, and my goods in them. That's the saints in heaven. My will brings beatitude, while in you it is operative, it's working, it's creating something. Is that okay? So they are receiving and enjoying. We are creating and producing. And I ask for your acts in order to multiply myself. So there it is, as clear as daylight. I'm asking for your acts. When you operate, I anxiously watch whether you operate in my will or not, so as to receive the contentment of seeing myself multiplied in your act. How attentive you should be, and let nothing escape you. So all of that needs an enormous amount of attention, okay? And it isn't any harm, I've said this before, to have a sheet of paper. I often do it myself when I'm doing this, and I just write down a whole list what is actually being stated in order to try and help me to take it on board. Because it's given to you in a whole dose of text. But if you actually separate it into individual statements and give space between them, you'd be amazed at how much it actually hits you. And this material is so incredible. It doesn't so much need explanation as just look at it, contemplate it, try and take it on board. And I say to the Lord, look, open my mind and open my spirit. Allow me to take it. And I just leave it then. Because it's not words that's needed. It's just a contemplation of this. But I think what we've just read is totally incredible. Okay. So May the 27th, 1922, is the prevenient act and the actual act. So those of you who are leading new groups, here's your teaching about the prevenient act and the actual act. And it's given to you straight. You don't have to increase it or anything. So just make sure you put a little note on this and say, this is where this teaching is. I was thinking to myself, Louisa said, if one act done in his will is so great, how many of them, alas, do I let escape? And my sweet Jesus moving in my interior told me, my daughter, there is the prevenient act and the actual act. So it comes directly from him. The prevenient act is when the soul, at the first rising of the day, fixes her will in mine and decides and confirms that she wants to live and operate in my volition. She anticipates all of her acts and she makes them all flow in my will. With the prevenient will, my sun rises. My will remains duplicated in all of her acts as though in one single act. And this makes up for the actual act. However, the prevenient act can be shaded, obscured by human ways, by one's own will, by self-esteem, by negligence and all the rest, like clouds before the sun that render it less vivid on the face of the earth. On the other hand, the actual act is not subject to clouds. On the contrary, it has the virtue of the power, we would say, of dispelling the clouds. The word virtue there is used meaning power. Come on, write it. It has the power of dispelling the clouds, if there are any, and it makes many more suns rise in which my life is duplicated with such vividness of light and heat as to form as many new suns, one more beautiful than the next. However, both of them are necessary. That's always a question you're asked in the early stages. The prevenient act gives the hand, disposes the forms and forms the plane for the actual act. The actual act preserves and expands the plane of the prevenient. That's absolutely needed for level one students. Okay. So in June the 1st, 1922, the subject has changed completely and she's meditating on Jesus before Pilate and the subject is What is Truth? Finding myself in my usual state, I was following in the hours of the Passion of my sweet Jesus, especially when he was presented to Pilate, who asked him what his kingdom was. And my beloved Jesus told me, my daughter, that was the first time in my terrestrial life that I dealt with a Gentile authority. It's an interesting point you wouldn't just think about. Who asked me what my kingdom was. Now, he had dealt with Gentiles before, but not the authority representing Rome, and not interested in what his kingdom was. And I answered them that my kingdom was not of this world, for if it were of this world, thousands of legions of angels would defend me, as you find in the gospel, okay? But with this, watch this, I opened my kingdom to the Gentiles. That's the bit you don't get when you're reading the gospel, okay? Not only that, but I communicated my celestial doctrines to them. Now you see the power of the divine will, that in a conversation that you think is sort of just a conversation, there's this extraordinary thing going on. So much so that Pilate asked me, what, are you a king? And immediately I answered him, I am a king. And I have come into the world to teach the truth. With this, I wanted to make my way into his mind in order to make myself known, so much so that touched, he asked me, but what is the truth? But he didn't wait for my answer. And that's one of the problems of human beings, that they may have a question, but they may not have the patience to get the answer. I did not have the good of making myself understood. But of course, Pilate did get the answer because when the Caesar eventually discovered that Pilate had crucified an innocent man, and this was totally abhorrent to the whole Roman idea of justice and authority, Pilate was sent a message by Caesar. And the message was, do away with yourself or go into exile, your choice. And Pilate decided to go into exile, and he went up into Gaul, what we call France, okay? I don't know if you should know this story. And on the way, when they were in their wagon leaving Israel and going through Asia Minor up towards France, they met a man who wasn't very tall, and he had bald head, and he had bandy legs, and who never stopped talking. And his name was Paul. And Paul stopped them, and Paul evangelized them. And Pilate said, but he would never forgive me. I crucified him knowing that he was innocent. And Paul said, well, I actually did worse than you. I actually crucified the members of his body afterwards. He said, I sinned against him in his spiritual state. You sinned against him in his physical state. He said, he forgave me, he'll forgive you. And he baptized Pilate there and then. Mm-hmm. And there's a tradition in the Orthodox Church. Catholics usually find this mind-blowing. But there's a tradition in the Orthodox Church of Saint Pilate and Saint Procula. Procula was the wife. Do you remember who told him to have nothing to do? Because Procula was a disciple of Jesus. Okay. I give you that here just to illuminate this little bit here, that Jesus, while he didn't get an immediate response because the crucifixion was decreed from heaven, okay, but the response was there, yeah, eventually, when he could accept forgiveness. With this, I wanted to make my way into his mind. Okay. But he didn't wait for an answer at this particular point. I did not have the good of making myself understood. I would have said to him, I am the truth. Everything is truth in me. This is wonderful teaching now. Now, the next bit is not English. My patience is truth. Okay. Truth is my patience doesn't work out in English, okay? Patience is my truth in the midst of so many insults. That's number one. That's the first statement he makes. My patience is truth. Number two, my sweet gaze is truth, among so many derisions, slanders, and contempts. Number three, my gentle and attractive manners are truth. In the midst of so many enemies who hate me while I love them, and who want to give me death while I want to embrace them and give them life. My words, full of dignity and of celestial wisdom, are truth. That's number four, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Okay. Everything is truth in me. The truth is more majestic than the sun, which, as much as one would want to trample on it, rises more beautiful and bright to the point of shaming its very enemies and of knocking them down to its feet. Pilate asked me with sincerity of heart. Now, we wouldn't know that unless Jesus said it, okay? And I was ready to answer. But Herod, rather, asked me with malice and curiosity, and I did not answer. So he kept silence in front of Herod. So to those who want to know holy things with sincerity, I reveal myself more than they expect. But with those who want to know them with malice and curiosity, I hide myself. And while they want to make fun of me, I confound them and make fun of them. How does he do that? Because they eventually, when you consider that Herod had to stand in front of Jesus in judgment after his death. That's where what he means by making fun of them, meaning showing how stupid their position was. Okay. However, since my person carried the truth within itself, it performed its office also in front of Herod. Herod would have known this holy man is not speaking to me because of my terrible life. Okay. And in case you don't know what his terrible life was, he had killed John the Baptist for telling him the truth. Okay. My silence at the stormy questions of Herod, my humble gaze, and the air of my person. Look at that, three things. Look at that. My silence, my humble gaze, and the very presence, okay, are all full of sweetness, of dignity and nobility. These were all truths and operating truths at that. In other words, everything spoke to him. And the only way that Herod could handle it was to mock him so that he wouldn't have to look at all of this. And you know that when they were abusing him in Caiaphas's house, they blinded him because they couldn't take his look. Okay. So we'll do one more tonight, and that's June the 6th. By living in the divine will, cross and sanctity become similar to those of Jesus. You'd have to say that cross. Okay. I was thinking to myself, how is it that my good Jesus has changed with me? Before, he would be all delighted in letting me suffer. Everything was participation in nails and cross. Now everything has vanished. It's going to take her quite a long time to realize that everything has in fact changed. That once he lifts her up to the level of the divine will, what he did before is not actually necessary. Okay. He's going to give her a completely different type of ministry. But no priest can tell her. The priest has to wait until these messages come and to try and understand the messages. Everything has vanished. He no longer delights in letting me suffer. And sometimes I suffer. He looks at me with such indifference. He no longer shows the taste of the past or the desire for what was happening in the past. So it's hard for us when circumstances begin to change and we have to adapt to a new way that we're not sure of and we don't know where it's going. We don't like going blindfold, do we? Now, spiritually, we find it much harder than we do in ordinary everyday life. So we have to know what's the destination of all of this stuff, and Jesus is going to talk to her. So while I was thinking of this, my sweet Jesus moving in my interior, sighing, told me, my daughter, when there are superior tastes, we would say satisfaction. Minor satisfactions lose their delight and their attractiveness, and therefore one looks at them with indifference. Okay? So she's been raised to the divine level. So what was happening on a lower level then doesn't interest him with her anymore. It will interest him with other people. The cross binds grace, but who nourishes it? Who makes it grow to the proper stature? It's my will. Now notice he's trying to explain the superior level to her. My will alone completes everything and allows my highest designs to be accomplished in the soul. If it wasn't for my will, even the cross, as much power and greatness as it contains, can cause souls to remain half on the way. We would say half baked. Okay. So they don't actually mature. Oh, how many suffer, but since the continuous nourishment of my will is missing, they do not reach the destination of undoing the human will. Whoops. You need to put a heading onto this paragraph. The destination is the undoing of the human will. So we can say all the prayers we like in the divine will, but if we're not allowing the undoing of the human will, we're actually not allowing the divine will to take over. Is that okay? That's why I've said over and over again that our motto must be, not my will, but thine be done. Is that okay? And the divine will cannot give the last blow, the final brush, the stroke of divine sanctity, which can only be given when the human will has actually surrendered. Okay. So you say, well, how on earth is this going to happen? I'm only little me. And he's going to now explain that every act you do in the divine will is like a nail that actually eventually achieves this. See, you say that nails and cross have vanished. This is false, my daughter, very false. Because before, your cross was small and incomplete. Now in my will, raising you into my will makes your cross become large. And each act you do in my will is a nail that your will receives. Now notice it's the will that has to receive the nails because it's the will that's got to surrender. And as you live in my will, yours extends so much as to diffuse you in every creature. Okay, so he's underlining that all the time now. And for each one of them, it gives me that life which I gave them, so as to render me the honour, the glory and the purpose for which I created. Her is the soul. See, your cross extends not only for you, but for each creature. Therefore, I see your cross everywhere. Before, I saw it only in you. That's before you entered the divine will. Now I see it everywhere. You're fusing yourself in my will with no personal interest, but only to give me that which all should give me and to give all the good that my will contains to everybody else. That you're fusing is only of the divine life and it's not of the human. So, my will alone is that which forms the divine sanctity of the soul. Now, Louisa needed that explanation very clearly because she thought that all the sanctity was in bearing the cross and sufferings. And he says, no, the cross and sufferings will sanctify you if the divine will wants it. And if the divine will is in it. If the divine will's not in it, forget about it. It has the same value as beating an animal in the field. It's really terrible. Okay. And people don't realise that. Like if I do a day of fasting and I'm doing it for myself, forget about it. It's of no value whatsoever. But if I'm doing it in the divine will and the divine will actually wants it, that's different. That's a totally different subject. And notice no personal interest. I'm not doing it for any benefit for me. Okay. So it's only the divine will that can form the divine sanctity in the soul. On the other hand, your previous crosses were human sanctity and therefore very limited. Now, what you're being shown here is the difference between all the sanctity outside of the divine will and the sanctity inside the divine will. They're just two different planets, is the way I put it. Okay. So on the other hand, your previous crosses were human sanctity, and that which is human, as holy as it may be, cannot do great things. Why? Because he's already told her, you're only an atom. They can only do small things. And even less can it elevate the soul to the sanctity and to the fusion with the working of her creator. Isn't that a beautiful way of talking about fusing? The fusion with the working of her creator. She remains always within the limitlessness of the creature. But my will, destroying all human barriers, flings the creature into the divine immensity, and everything becomes immense in her. Cross, nails, sanctity, love, reparation, everything. My goal in you was not human sanctity, although it was necessary to first do the small things in you. And this is why I delighted so much. That's why I insist on everybody doing volumes 1 to 4. It's the human sanctity. It's to get them on their feet, to put the proper foundations in so you can build up towards the divine sanctity. But if there's something missing in the foundations, they're not going to pick it up later. There's no way. The next paragraph is that the human will has to be crucified. It's as simple as that. Now, as I made you go beyond, and having to make you live in my volition, in seeing your littleness, your atom, embrace immensity in order to give me love and glory for all and for each one, to render me all the rights of the whole of creation, I am so delighted that all other things give me no taste or satisfaction anymore. Do you see that satisfaction fits the word better than taste? Therefore, your cross, your nails will be my will, which, keeping your will crucified, will complete the true crucifixion in you. Now, she thought the crucifixion was that I actually go physically through this. And he says, no, it has got to happen to your will. The true crucifixion, it will not be at intervals, but it will be perpetually, and it will be fully similar to mine. It's an unspeakable privilege for a creature. As I was conceived crucified and I died crucified. That means the will was completely to the Father altogether. My cross was nourished by the eternal will alone, and therefore I was crucified for all and for each one. You see why it's for all and for each one? Because the crucifixion was done in the divine will. And therefore, everything about it was sanctified and had power to redeem everybody. And he explains in these volumes that if he had only done it on a human level, he couldn't have redeemed everybody. There's no way. It wouldn't have been possible. My cross marked everyone with its emblem. Now, there's a very important statement there, much more important than you think. Because when you go into Revelation 13, verses 16 to 17, you read about the mark of the beast. Okay? But in Revelation 9, 4, you find that the saints are marked. And people have always queried as to what this mark is. Is that mark the baptismal mark on your forehead? And Jesus says it's the mark of the cross. Isn't that interesting? So spiritually, we can be read on the spiritual plane as belonging to different groups because of marks that we can't see. So if we have the mark of the cross, then we're identified with Jesus's kingdom. The mark of Satan is different. Okay. And the mark is always something. You notice that Hindus put the mark just there between the eyes. And that's because it represents the intellect, and the soul is represented more in the intellect than anywhere else. The soul is throughout your entire body, but it operates, the intelligence operates from there. That's why the mark is on the intelligence. That's what the Lord explains about the mark of the beast. It's not this RFID chip that they're all talking about. It's not that at all. It's what you give your intelligence to. That's why it's spoken of as a mark on the forehead, what you give your intelligence to. And it's spoken about as a mark on your hand. It's what you give your life to or your works to. Okay. So don't worry about what other people are going mad about. It's an interior mark. Okay. But I think it's very interesting here that the Lord speaks about it as the mark of the cross. So we'll stop there for tonight.